We're talking about whether there is a federal economic relief package anywhere on the horizon. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President-elect Joe Biden urged Congress this week to immediately pass a $3 trillion stimulus plan as the COVID crisis intensifies across our nation.
We're going into a very dark winter. Things are going to get much tougher before they get easier. And that requires sparing no effort to fight COVID so that we can open our businesses safely, resume our lives, and put this pandemic behind us. It's going to be difficult, but it can be done.
What questions do you have about the stalled stimulus negotiations? Do you agree with the positions of either side? What does our economy need now? We're at 800-642-1234. Catherine Rampell is an opinion columnist at The Washington Post, where she writes about economics, public policy, and politics. Catherine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great to be here.
Well, the government has not authorized a large stimulus since the CARES Act passed in March, $2.2 trillion. You know, I heard Oregon Governor Kate Brown last night on NPR saying, look, Democrats need to make some concessions here. Republicans have to pull through and deliver for the American people because a record number of people in the U.S. are hospitalized. States are shutting down. What is going on in Capitol Hill?
That is an excellent question, given that there have been many, many, many months since the last major fiscal action was taken to come to an agreement on an additional one. And since then, of course, the economy has improved, which maybe in some people's eyes suggests that there is less pressure to get something done. But the problem is that that improvement has been slowing down. That we started out in the summer adding a ton of jobs, and then that job growth has continued but has been slowing, has sort of been petering out. A lot of other economic indicators suggest that the recovery is stalling. And meanwhile, our politicians on Capitol Hill do not seem able to come to an agreement on what should be done about any of that. And of course, with infection surging, that increases the risk that the recovery could peter out and the economic need will be even greater.
Yeah, and there are 44 days until the end of the year when some, you know, money then becomes unavailable or money runs out. And so we're looking with our eye to December 31st and saying, then what?
Right. There are certain programs that expire entirely. So listeners may recall that lawmakers had passed three major unemployment insurance expansions. One was increasing the generosity of benefits that by an additional $600 per week. That expired over the summer. There are two other programs, one making people eligible for unemployment benefits for longer periods of time, you know, given how serious this crisis is, and then the other one, expanding eligibility for benefits. So if you're a gig worker, freelancer, contractor, Uber driver, whatever, you can now qualify for benefits. Those two programs will expire around Christmas. Already people are exhausting them if they happen to have been unlucky enough to have gotten laid off from their job very early in the year. But there's going to be a huge wave of people who just stop getting that much needed aid that helps them buy groceries and, you know, pay the rent, pay whatever bills that they have. They're all going to lose their benefits again around Christmas. So there is some urgency here.
Yeah, and it's a fine line here, because what happens to Main Street, to businesses, if Congress stalls on relief funds and small businesses have burned through their savings? How did they make it through?
That's an excellent question. And I think that's the other key constituency here, right? It's households are suffering. They need aid through unemployment insurance, through food assistance, through other things that will help them get by. But so do businesses. We've seen a huge wave of small business closures over the past several months. And there's a question about whether those businesses that have closed will ever be able to reopen. In surveys that have been conducted, you know, or other data sources, like if you Yelp has been putting out data on, you know, what share of businesses that are listed on their platform are open versus closed. And if they're closed, is it temporary versus permanent? those numbers have been quite concerning, suggesting that a lot of firms are going to close permanently, not because, you know, their business models were somehow defective before COVID, not because they were uncompetitive, they weren't productive, they didn't manage well, whatever. The problem is that they can't operate while we have a pandemic, either because you know, there might be some sort of state restrictions on the ability to go to the gym or eat at an indoor restaurant or what have you, or because consumers are just afraid to partake of those activities while the pandemic is still raging. So the real question is, how do we make sure that until we have a broadly available vaccine, that businesses can continue, businesses that are still, that would otherwise be viable businesses, can continue to get by so that they're, you know, ready to go when the economy is prepared for them to do so, right? That that when people are ready to go back to work and ready to go back to the normal economic activities, there will still be jobs there for them and shops for them to go to and other, you know, businesses for them to patronize. And that's really a risk here that, you know, the sort of productive capacity of the economy will be permanently or enduringly, if not permanently, affected by these prolonged closures and fear of engaging in, you know, our normal economic lives.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Catherine Rampell, who's been writing for The Washington Post about the economy and the need for Congress to act on a stimulus bill. She's an opinion writer at The Post. You can join in. What would you like to see in the next relief and economic stimulus bill? What support do you need during the pandemic? What support does your community need and your family need? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Gary joining us from Iron River. Hi, Gary. What's on your mind?
Good morning, ladies. I'd like to understand what the real truth is of this HEROES Act with regard to state and municipal aid. The Republicans have said that it bails out poorly run states with giant deficits in pension funds like New York and Illinois to the detriment of a state like Wisconsin, who has a very well-run and well-funded pension plan. And you never hear, I don't hear a rebuttal to that, but I don't know what the truth is, and would like to understand how the states will be treated and be treated equitably.
Okay, sure. Thanks. Yeah.
Sure. So it is true that a number of states entered this pandemic recession, whatever you want to call it, on poor fiscal footing. But independent of that, the pandemic has wreaked havoc on state and municipal finances pretty much across the board. Red states, blue states, states that had pre-existing pension obligations that were out of whack, and those that didn't. And if you look at the data, I'm going to see if I can pull this up while we're on the show, but in any event, it shows that a number of red states, for example, or purple states, also are facing major budgetary shortfalls in the next year or two, and that's for a couple of reasons. One is that with business closures and people and consumers pulling back from their normal spending, that means there's less tax revenue coming in, whether from income taxes or from sales taxes or other sources of revenue. So there's less money going into state coffers. And then also there's greater demand for public services as well, because people need various kinds of assistance. And, you know, there's been some federal help with that, but arguably not enough. States and localities are, generally speaking, bound by balanced budget rules, often through their constitution. So they cannot borrow to make up that difference. So the proposals that are on the table at the federal level are basically saying, look, the feds can borrow. They may as well help these states make ends meet in the meantime. So it's not just about bailing out, you know, past profligacy. It's about helping them make ends meet now.
And talking with Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we inquire about the status of a new economic stimulus plan on Capitol Hill. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President-elect Joe Biden said Monday it's imperative for lawmakers to pass a COVID relief package during the lame duck session before they adjourn next month. But Politico reports there are no active discussions between Republicans and Democrats on such a plan. They said yesterday the White House is silent, the Hill is quiet, and a number of crucial provisions expire, as we've been talking about, at the end of the year. So how has your work been affected by the lack of federal economic support? Are you a business owner? What can you share about your experience? 800-642-1234 to join in. Catherine Rampell is a Washington Post columnist, and she stays with us. Let's bring in Kyle joining us from Sheboygan. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. I just wanted to comment my opinion. There's three things that the government should do that are not, you know, a handout as far as, you know, giving money, but better testing, more funding for testing and contact tracing, and, you know, widely distributing the vaccines that are coming out and making that available. In my opinion, they're getting this pandemic under control is going to help stimulate our economy. It goes hand in hand, in my opinion. Thank you.
Yeah, Kyle, thank you. So Kyle is saying to get the economy on track, it's more testing, more contact tracing, and making sure vaccines are available widely. Catherine, what do you think of that?
I think that's absolutely right, that in the long run, public health and economic interests are aligned, that we will not get the economy back on a solid footing until the public health crisis is addressed. And that won't happen, of course, until we have a widely available vaccine. In the meantime, there are also other things we can do that are sort of low-hanging, non-costly fruit, right? I mean, we don't have, I feel like this question always gets framed as, well, is there a trade-off between allowing businesses to operate and getting the vaccine under control and maybe in the near term? But there are things like, you know, encouraging or mandating mask wearing that is very cheap. It's annoying. I agree. I don't like wearing a mask. Most people don't. But it's not nearly as costly as having to spend another, you know, few trillion dollars keeping businesses afloat. So there are these kinds of public health interventions short of, you know, the distribution of a vaccine, which will ultimately come and hopefully sooner rather than later that we could be engaging in. And testing and tracing, obviously, that will cost money. That's not free. But probably the return on investment on that is enormous if it means that we can keep infections under control sufficiently so that more economic activity can resume more quickly.
It seems like there's quite a bit of divide here between Democrats wanting a neighborhood $3.4 trillion plan. Republicans have offered $650 billion on the table. What are the sticking points here? You know, why the vast difference in what they want to accomplish in this plan with the dollars they want to spend?
Sure. So it's not just a matter of, well, one side wants this amount of money and one side this wants that amount of money. So why don't we just take, you know, the midpoint between the two and just do that? There are actually differences in composition between the various proposals. So, for example, in the most recent bill that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, had put forward, I believe there was no aid to state and municipal governments, which, as we've been discussing, are really hurting and are on the verge of having even more layoffs than they have, which, you know, would add more pain. So McConnell has since said that he's open to having aid for state and local governments, but it wasn't at least in that most recent bill. There's also a question of, you know, should there be those another round of those $1,200 checks to Americans around the country? They seem to go back and forth on whether they will allow that. I believe the most recent proposal, I think, from Republicans did not have that, but they seem open to it. So there are, you know, core elements that the Democrats have basically said, look, this is really not negotiable. We don't want states and localities to go broke. We don't want first responders to get laid off as a result of that and have, you know, another wave of layoffs just compounding all of the economic pain we've already had. And Republicans have said, well, why don't we just do the things we agree on? And, you know, you can argue it both ways. Maybe they should just come together on the things that they agree on. From the Democrats' perspective, I think they're saying, but then there will never be pressure to get all of this other really critical stuff through. Mm-hmm. So there are major sticking points on substance and negotiation tactics, of course. But either way, I think there really is need for both sides to come to some sort of agreement, because we can't just wait until January when a new administration is in to kind of get these talks restarted.
Yeah. So what is the role here of the incoming administration? Because, you know, we were watching President-elect Biden's speech very closely Monday for any hints of whether he was offering some compromise on that $3 trillion. Didn't hear much there.
I think he's mostly just hoping that they get something done.
Okay.
Was my takeaway from that speech. I believe he had praised the most recent version of the HEROES Act, which was smaller than the original version of the HEROES Act. But I think he's mostly just hoping that something moves between now and January so that the existing economic pain out there doesn't get worse.
If nothing moves mm-hmm. between now and January, what happens to our economy?
I'm very worried about that prospect, especially because infections are rising, have been rising. It's getting colder. That seems correlated with greater transmission of the virus. The vaccine is still a little ways off. So those kinds of factors could definitely weigh on the economy, on again, consumers' willingness to go out and engage in economic activities and businesses' ability to survive and continue having people on their payrolls. So I'm very concerned about that. And then, as we've been talking about, this is really not about necessarily stimulating the economy. It's really more about providing relief so that households and businesses can kind of get by until we have the pandemic really under control through a widely distributed vaccine. So I think there's going to be a lot of suffering in the meantime if, in fact, another round of fiscal relief, you can call it stimulus, but it's really better characterized as just like alleviating the pain. If that doesn't come through, I think you're going to see a lot of suffering, you know, potential waves of evictions, and already the numbers for food insecurity and things like that are distressingly high. So mm-hmm. I think you'll see that continue. You'll probably see some even more permanent business closures.
We're talking with Catherine Rampell, who writes about the economy and public policy for The Washington Post, an opinion columnist there, taking your questions about what you see. What questions do you have about the stalled negotiations in Congress regarding relief? Join in. Do you agree with the positions? What do you want to see come out of it? 800-642-1234. You know, Catherine, states are looking at these mask mandates and other mandates and trying to, figure out how to enforce them, right? And there's been talk about, do you fine people? Do you arrest people for exceeding the social gathering limits? Do you shut businesses down that don't comply? What are you seeing out there in terms of enforcement?
It seems to really vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and I've seen examples where this may even be true in Wisconsin, I'm not sure, where at the state level they've mandated one thing and then the local sheriff has essentially rebelled and said we're not going to enforce that. I think it's really sad at this point that, again, this very easy, relatively non-costly public health intervention has been so politicized. And I don't know exactly the right way to depoliticize it, except to have our leaders of various kinds, whether political or religious or otherwise, just say, hey, guys, you know, this isn't going to end transmission, but it can severely curb it. This is an easy thing we can do, which it shows, respect for your neighbors and family members and colleagues, and it'll help keep you and your own family a little bit safer. So this is better than alternative options that we have. Mm-hmm. And I would really love to see, even short of enforcement, just more leadership on this issue. Because again, it's just not an expensive, it's an inexpensive intervention, and it's something that could really help.
In our last 30 seconds here, what are you watching for out there in DC from your vantage point? What should we be watching for?
That's a good question. You know, I'm looking at how politicians are interpreting the numbers as they come in. Are they celebrating the fact that the economy is still growing, or are they paying attention to the fact that it's growing more slowly, that it's decelerating? I'm paying attention to what kinds of comments are being made about the viability of various fiscal relief programs. You know, how much agreement is there on unemployment benefits? How much agreement is there on schools? You know, getting more aid for schools, which we haven't talked about at all, but is really another thing that we should be prioritizing at the expense of almost everything else. But I'm quite concerned that if they don't act quickly enough, again, that there will be a lot of unnecessary financial pain endured now and a lot of enduring scarring effects for the months and years ahead.
Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Catherine Rampell is an opinion columnist at The Washington Post. Coming up, the state Supreme Court is hearing a case that challenges the statewide mask mandate. We'll talk about it right after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we discuss pandemic-related litigation to restrain the power of the governor and legislation to rein in the COVID upsurge in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republican lawmakers have sued Democratic governors over their COVID orders in at least seven states, according to Stateline, the new service from Pew Charitable Trusts. Here in Wisconsin, the state Supreme Court heard arguments Monday over whether to strike down the mask mandate that expires in 3 days. Meanwhile, Governor Evers presented a bill to deal with the pandemic yesterday. What can you say about how state government is handling this crisis? What should be acted on now? What should go to the governor's desk? 800-642-1234 to join in. Patrick Marley covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So Governor Evers released a proposal to tackle the surging pandemic yesterday, and Assembly Speaker Voss held a separate presser and outlined Republican priorities without legislation. Where are we at this morning?
So clearly there's a long way to go here for anything to pass. Governor Evers put out his plan after Speaker Voss said that he would be holding a news conference to talk about, to put forward some ideas to deal with COVID. And it turns out that the governor had presented to top Republicans in the legislature on Monday his plan. When he learned that Speaker Voss was going to be having this news conference, Evers put out his plan, which would cost $541 million, most of which would go toward testing, but there would be some other spending to deal with COVID and some tax breaks for small businesses in there. Voss turned out to not have any legislation, but rather some general ideas that he wanted to do. He's interested in doubling the number of contact tracers in the state, said that he wants to have more rapid tests, wants to have at-home testing, but hasn't put any of this into legislation yet. Meanwhile, over in the Senate, the incoming Senate President, Senator Chris Kapinga, said that he didn't think anything needed to be done at all regarding COVID. And so it's very clear that it would be an extremely difficult road to get anything passed and onto Evers' desk right now.
So very different approaches here in the sentiment. Evers putting forth a proposal and Republicans talking more broadly about ideas that they back. Is there any notion that they're going to come together to talk here and to actually put something into policy?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to know that you've got some Republican lawmakers who are talking about ideas and saying they want to work with Evers on it. And there are others, such as those who control the Senate, who are saying they don't think any action at all is necessary. So even if Voss and Evers were able to cut a deal, which is a big if, they would have to get it approved by the Senate as well. And the early signs there, or maybe not early because we've been in this pandemic for many months, are that they don't want to take action over there. So, I would say the outlook for a deal is very low right now.
You know, we spoke with Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke earlier in the week, Monday, and said to us that, you know, look, he said we passed policies early this year that gave the governor all the power and money he needed to respond to the pandemic. $2.2 billion, another pot of state money that the governor hasn't touched, ability to transfer employees. So from that vantage point, what is the governor asking for here that goes beyond what Steinke said his needs were met?
So one thing to keep in mind is that it's not the legislature that gave the governor the ability to spend this $2 billion in federal funds. That was set by Congress and longstanding existing law. So the legislature didn't do anything to give him additional control of that money. In fact, Speaker Voss has expressed some regrets that the legislature didn't have some say in how that $2 billion is spent. The lawmakers did in their legislation give an additional $75 million in state money that Evers could use. Evers didn't spend any of that. He says he didn't do that because at the same time, the state was suffering, the budget effects of COVID and was making cuts across state government to deal with lowering tax revenue. And legislators were saying they wanted deeper cuts. Meanwhile, Evers had this $2 billion in federal aid, so he didn't spend the state money. The legislature did pass this bill in April that did a lot of things, but many of those were temporary in nature. Many of those have expired or will be expiring soon as the year turns. So Evers says new legislation is needed. Like I say, the federal money has to be spent by the end of this year. And so he wants to start using state money to continue the testing that we've got going on. That's a big portion of the $540 million. Voss says that's too expensive. He doesn't want to use state money, at least not at that level. He said he's willing to spend some state money, but he didn't say how much money he's willing to spend. The fact is right now there's no more federal money will be coming in after this $2 billion is spent, unless Congress acts, which is a possibility.
Talking with Patrick Marley, who covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, he's getting us up to speed on how state government is responding to the pandemic, taking your questions as well on COVID and the state response with policy 800-642-1234. Michael is joining us from Bear Valley this morning. Hi, Michael.
Hello. I just have a very simple, quick question. I'm 71 years old. This is the worst health crisis of my lifetime in the state. And I was wondering why we continue to pay these representatives when they won't come to work and deal on this crisis. Just simple question.
Michael, thanks. Patrick, Michael wants to see them come together. And why should they be paid if they can't work together?
Well, there's no real way to withhold their pay. State lawmakers make a little over $50,000 a year. That's obviously paid by taxpayers. They're paid as full-time workers, even though in the campaign years they don't come to the Capitol very much. It's typical in even-numbered years for them to not show up after the spring until after the election. This year is anything but typical. Obviously, the governor and some Democrats have said that they need to be taking action. Lawmakers haven't done that. But ultimately, it's a matter to voters to decide. We just had an election. There's not a way to withhold pay from lawmakers for failing to act.
Going back to the piece of legislation that Evers unveiled yesterday, what are some of the top line highlights here? I mean, you certainly mentioned continuing the contact tracing with state dollars, the testing. You know, we're 44 days to the end of the year. What would this bill pick up and continue?
So another thing it would do is make changes to the unemployment system. We've got normally when you go make a claim for unemployment, you have to wait a week before you get benefits. So that first week that you're out of a job, you don't get any benefits. The legislature suspended that in the spring because so many people were coming onto the unemployment rolls, through no fault of their own. The businesses were closing because of COVID. Evers would extend that to the end of 2021. Voss was skeptical of doing that. He said he wasn't sure that he could support that. Another thing Evers wants to do is ban the initiation of any new eviction or foreclosure procedures. Obviously, there's a lot of people who can't pay their rent or make their mortgage right now because they're out of work. Voss says he doesn't think that would be good for the economy, so he was unwilling to go along with that. There's a number of other provisions that Evers wants to do that are in the same vein as what we had in the spring, such as waiving the requirement for people to show up in person to get certain government licenses or do other paperwork so that more of that can be done remotely. And he also wants to extend the COVID coverage from insurers to require insurers to cover treatment and testing and vaccines without having the insured person have to pay a portion of that cost.
Let's bring in Barb, who is joining us now. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I heard on your news that one of the things the governor wants to do is allow people not to pay rent, and that Speaker Voss says that's not a good idea. Isn't it true Speaker Voss is a landlord, so he's just looking out for his own pocket instead of his constituents who are suffering during this time?
Patrick, go ahead.
As I just mentioned, that's right, that there could be no eviction. So if somebody stopped paying their rent, they couldn't be kicked out of their apartment. Same thing is true for homeowners with mortgages. Yes, Voss is a landlord, as are a number of other lawmakers. Some have questioned that and called that a conflict. He says it's not. Obviously, not every lawmaker, but many lawmakers have private sector jobs. Most do. So, we have lawyers in the legislature. We have nurses in the legislature, and what these lawmakers say is that they act on behalf of the people across their industry and not themselves specifically. But yes, it's true that Voss is a landlord. He would very much be affected by that provision on eviction.
Are all eyes here on Capitol Hill right now that, lawmakers in our state are really looking to see what the federal government's next move is here on a relief package before acting? I mean, is that the situation?
Well, absolutely. That's going to be crucial to whatever Wisconsin does or doesn't do. Congress itself has been stalled since passing the CARES Act and a couple other pieces of legislation. And there's a lot of pressure on them to do something. It's unclear if they will. If they were to act, that could, again, send Wisconsin and other states billions of dollars, which would, if they structured it the same way as last time, would give Evers free rein as to how to spend that money. And he would have an ability to do some things without the say-so of the legislature. But lawmakers, no matter what, state lawmakers are still going to have a crucial role here. You mentioned the court case that there is now, and that centers largely on what the governor can do on his own. It's clear under any case that there's going to be some role for the legislature here.
We're going to look at the litigation here in a moment with Patrick Marley, cover state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Taking your thoughts on as well on this, is the mask mandate overreach? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Patrick Marley here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. We're checking in on developments at the state capitol as our state shatters records for COVID deaths and hospitalizations. Deaths were reported in more than half of our state's counties on Tuesday. Governor Evers released a relief bill that fell flat. Incoming Senate President Chris Kapinga told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that he hasn't seen anything that he's real excited about. How do we get beyond this impasse? What should happen next? 800-642-1234. Patrick Marley, state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, is our guide. So, Patrick, let's head to the state Supreme Court, where they heard arguments Monday related to the mask mandate, the statewide mask mandate. What is going on in that court battle?
So that case is actually even broader than that, because it looks at whether the governor can issue these kinds of health orders that he has been since spring. State law says the governor can declare a health emergency that lasts for 60 days, and then the legislature can cut that off or can extend it. The lawmakers let that stand but did not extend it. And so Evers' response to that was to declare additional emergencies, and then under that issue things like the mask mandate and the capacity limits on bars and restaurants and stores. And so the case at hand says that the governor can't issue multiple emergencies for the same situation. So COVID-19, the plaintiff argues, he gets one chance to issue a 60-day emergency order and do things under that. After that point, he needs to get the permission of lawmakers, which they have not given him. And so Evers says this is COVID-19 is like a river that floods. You can have the same river flood multiple times in a season and cause multiple emergencies. COVID-19 has ebbed and flowed, when it has surged, he's been able to issue new emergency orders, he claims. The state Supreme Court heard arguments this week and was seemingly pretty skeptical of this argument that he could issue more than one emergency order. If the justices were to say that he only gets one shot at that and then must get the permission of lawmakers, that would really clip the governor's ability to act in, do many of the things that he's been doing over the last 7 or 8 months.
It seems the governor has been hemmed in by courts at every turn here, right? I mean, he can't enforce gatherings, mask mandates, emergency orders without a challenge, without a court fight. What does that say here about trying to get COVID under control and the governor's powers?
Well, I mean, he definitely faced a huge setback in spring. He put the stay-at-home order in place. That was challenged directly by Republican lawmakers who went to the state Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court sided with the lawmakers 4-3. At that time, the legislature said that it was working on legislation to put in place rules in conjunction with the governor. That never came to fruition. The two sides, soon after that court decision, had their talks completely break down. They didn't speak for 6 months or more. And so, you've really seen, as we saw with this other legislation that we're discussing recently, that they just aren't seeing eye to eye at all. So if the Supreme Court were to find that Evers and the lawmakers have to work together, the likeliest outcome would be that nothing would happen because the two are unable so far to get along. Now, I suppose a more charitable view would be that a Supreme Court decision like that would force the two sides together and to work together. But they seemed to offer an opinion in May that would have forced that kind of discussion, and it just simply didn't happen.
What is the timeline here on a decision?
So the court hasn't said when it will rule, but it has really put this case on a fast track. It was filed a very short time ago directly with the Supreme Court rather than with a lower court, as cases typically are. The Supreme Court agreed to take it quite quickly and scheduled arguments. I think all of that happened within 3 weeks or so. And so to have a decision within a matter of weeks would not be surprising to me.
Meanwhile, the statewide mask mandate ends in 72 hours or so. What then?
Well, certainly the governor could extend that. We don't know what he might do, but, barring a new court order, he has the ability to put in place an extension of that mask mandate or other things until the court tells him otherwise.
Let's bring in Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich. What are your thoughts?
Hi. My thoughts are that we're entering a holiday period. I mean, one of them is coming up very quickly, Thanksgiving, alongside deer hunting season. That's not the holiday. But what most of us call the end of year holidays or Christmas holidays, it would seem to me a real missed opportunity on the part of the legislators to show a public goodwill towards future health in Wisconsin by getting their heads together with the governor and presenting a united front. I'm very worried that Wisconsin, which is a hospitality state, we get a lot of tourists, is looking at a very bad economy in 2021 if we don't do something like unite to face what is a crisis.
Rich, thanks. Rich, certainly concerned at the end of the year here, the optics of not acting. Patrick?
Yeah, so again, to underscore, the all signs are on not acting at the moment. You know, there's no, very little sign of progress. I suppose the fact that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was out putting forward some ideas is a sign of at least one house wanting to do something, because previously the Assembly had said there's little that the government could do. But with the Senate's position that it has taken, again, just not to sound like a broken record, but it seems unlikely that they will act. The holiday season is definitely something that has health officials nationally and probably internationally very concerned, because you're going to have people traveling, people seeing families, and you know, whenever people are moving around and getting together in any fashion, that's when the illness spreads.
Patrick, I want to ask you about the status of the canvassing. You know, so many things on your plate here, but certainly the election being something that's on our, as we're watching here, canvassing has finished. President Trump has hours now to ask for a recount. What is the status there?
Yeah, so yesterday, the last of the counties finished their canvass, which is sort of the finalization at the local level of all of the results from November 3rd. And as is typical, there's small changes. Joe Biden slightly widened his narrow lead to about 20,600 votes out of 3 million cast. So that's about a 6/10 of a percentage point win. That's within the range that allows Trump to request and receive a recount. He has said he would do that, but he hasn't formally made the request. He's got to do that by 5 p.m. today. If he does it on a statewide level, he's going to have to pay $8 million up front. State law requires an advance payment for the cost of a recount for a losing candidate, unless it's narrower than it is in this case. So we're waiting to see what the president does. Does he really follow through on this recount? If he does he go with a full recount of all 72 counties, or does he pick just a handful of counties? There's been some talk that he looks at Milwaukee County and maybe a few other counties to do the recount, which would you know, save him quite a bit of money.
And after this canvass process is now complete, is there also an audit that is done, a sampling that is done at the state level?
They do a sampling of these audits to confirm that there weren't problems, or to try to identify any problems that may have occurred. And I'll be honest, I'm not sure if they do that in conjunction with the audit or in conjunction with the canvass, or if that's yet to come.
Well,
the next stage is... whether or not there's a recount, the state is to certify the result by December 1st. So whatever happens here, we are on our way to a final tally quite soon.
Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Marley covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Just ahead, a disinformation fellow joins us to explain how Russia spread disinformation in the campaign leading up to the 2020 election, much like in 2016. We'll talk about it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.